Thank you for joining us for Wednesday's edition of Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR or AM 870 WKAR if you're joining us here during the noon hour. Nearly 21 years ago, an airplane carrying Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana and Burundian President Cyprien Intaryamira was shot down, killing all on board. The crash ignited a four-year-old Rwandan civil war into what would become the Rwandan genocide, a mass slaughter of Tutsi and moderate Hutu in Rwanda by members of the Hutu majority. During the approximately 100-day period from April to July 1994, an estimated million Rwandans were killed, as much as 20% of the country's total population and 70% of the Tutsi then living in Rwanda. Perpetrators came from the ranks of the Rwandan army, the national police, government-backed militias, and the Hutu civilian population. Immaculée Ilibagiza was a teenage Rwandan Tutsi in 1994. Her entire family was murdered during the tragedy. In the years since, Miss Ilibagiza has traveled the world telling her personal story of a world gone mad. She comes to Michigan this Friday and Saturday to present the seminar Treasures of Our Faith, a weekend of healing at hope and hope at Fowler's Most Holy Trinity Church. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Ilibagiza by phone recently to discuss those dark mid-90s days and what's happened since.
You know, I knew something was not going well between the tribes. It was almost like at the level of the leaders. Between friends, nobody ever heard me or looked at me angry as a friend and hated me because I was Tutsi. You know, when we spoke about it, I just never wanted to talk about the tribe. I had a boyfriend and he was from the other tribe and he was a Hutu. So still, I never saw anyone treating anybody bad because you were the other tribe.
But there's a perception of the other. There's someone who's the other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Anytime we went to school, we had to write down who we were, if you were Tutsi or Hutu, because we look alike. You know, so if you have to ask for a job, you have to write down if you're Tutsi or Hutu. Every exam you did, you have to write down if you're Tutsi or Hutu. You know, every school, every job, every place you entered, you know how here they have like a driver license.
Right.
You had a card that was written Hutu Tutsi. So if you go in the building, you have to show if you're Tutsi or Hutu. So it was just like so much like a policy of the people, of the government, for the fear of sharing the power that they wanted. If there's too many people who go to school, they don't want too many Tutsis in school. If you, people who, it was sad.
There was a plane crash, a fateful plane crash that, as I understand it, was the spark for the violence that broke out. Do you remember that and what happened?
Yeah, I remember that. It was not just like only the spark, but I think it was planned.
Yes.
And I still remember the day before. I mean, I remember a friend of asking me like a week before, and this man said, you know, he was working in the UN and working at our school. He said, you know, you students, what do you think? What do you think about, is any possibility for war? I don't know where that came from me. But I told him, I said, it's almost like it's about rain and you can't stop it. The clouds are already over us. And I don't know why I said it, but it was heavy. It was heavy. You knew something was terribly wrong. Another sign, a day before the genocide started, the president was killed. My brother came home. He came inside our living room. And he, I remember he told my father, he said, Dad, my friend who's a Hutu just told me that they are dropping military in every corner, and in Teramo, people who the killers who were killed went to kill people tonight, Tutsis, whom they have on list. And my father was like, where did you hear that? He's like, my friend is really connected, and he's a Hutu, he's a good man. He's trying to protect us, and he said we are on the list, so we must go away. The president who was in power, there is no way he could have allowed anyone to kill people under his mandate. A million people.
That was President Habyarimana.
That was Habyarimana, yes.
Yeah.
That was the beginning when they killed him.
He crashed along with the Burundian president, and violence broke out immediately. Is that right?
Yeah, right away. Or 10 minutes later, they have killed maybe the first family. BBC Radio reported 18 families that were killed. 18 families. I mean, everyone was confused. Why children? Eight children and mom and dad. Five children and mom and dad. Grandma and grandpa. I remember my dad saying, this never happened before. Where whole family is killed. They have killed people, but not a family. What's going on? And that's why they call it a genocide, yeah.
Will you take us back to what happened with you and your family?
Well, at the beginning, my parents asked me to go to hide. You know, it was the first, second day, maybe. I think they asked me to go to a neighbor, and they did ask. Of course, I was the one girl among three boys. They just wanted to see me safe. I didn't want to go. I really left out of obedience to my parents. So I went to a neighbor who was from the other tribe, the Hutu tribe, and I really have to tell you this. Not even half of the Hutus were killing. But the government was killing in the name of the Hutu tribe. The government was in power. So my parents sent me to this man whom they knew was a good man. This man put me to sit in a bathroom 3 by 4 feet with other seven women. We spent in that place 3 months. We were hoping it was going to be 2-3 days. If it is really bad, we spent there 3 months. And when I came out, I found out everyone in my family was killed.
A calamity of such epic proportions, so massive in size and scope, the truth of it is far beyond journalism's reach. 1.5 million Rwandans, nearly 20% of the country's entire population, trying desperately to survive one more day in this relentless...
You were in a room with seven other women of about 12 square feet. How did you survive? How did you eat? What were the conditions like? I can't even imagine.
No. The man who was hiding us, he gave us food.
Yeah.
So he will come to the room at night especially and put one plate of food among us, and we just eat what we can eat. So it was not easy to survive. I mean, anytime I go back, I say, like, what? This is the place? Now he passed away, the man who was hiding us. But I used to ask him, like, you didn't change the bathroom? Is it this small? Was it, did he change the color? He said, no, I never touched it. So, but we stayed there. It was really by the grace of God. But also I realized when you are about to die, I mean, you will do anything. You will do anything if it means to save your life. You know, like a small place like that can hold you. You normally when you are tired after an hour and sitting in a small place, you want to sit there forever if it means to save your life.
How have you changed since this experience more than 20 years ago?
It changed me a lot in terms of life, you know, how I see life. I see life as a journey, but a journey that has an end. You know, I really have to remind myself that we don't belong here. We are passengers. And another thing I realize is that our work lives forever. So the action we do, things we live, the love we show the people, it really lives forever. We have to be careful of what we do, you know? And the only thing that survives out of everything is love. Bad memories, people remember, but they forget. But the good things you have done, they will live in neighbors, they will live in those who will read your story, your writing, they live forever. So love is really become very important after the genocide, you know, reaching out to other people. Because in the end, again, it will go away. But the work you have done to care for others will live forever.
This is Peter Worf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Imakule Ilibagiza. She's telling us the story today of the 1994 Rwandan genocide and her experiences. She lived for 91 days with seven other women in a small bathroom in a neighbor's house, an area no larger than 12 square feet.
It is not like the famine in Somalia. It is not like the flight of the Iraqi Kurds into the mountains of Iran and Turkey. It is not like the siege of Sarajevo or the plight of Bosnians displaced by that war. It is not like anything I've ever seen in 30 years as a reporter. It is, I think, the standard against which all future tragedies will be measured. For all up and down this road that leads north...
Imakule, what do you do today? What's your life like today?
Well, now, right now, I do travel a lot as I'm coming there, and I go around and speak and share my story. I mean, people invite me sometimes. I think, like, I spoke enough. But when people invite me, especially when I hear letters that come back to me, emails and people telling me, you still have changed mine. I'm a better husband, I'm a better wife, I'm a better child, or I forgive somebody who did this to me, my friend who I didn't talk to in a year or 2 years. It really gives me the courage to continue to share. And I love it. You know, I learned that we must forgive each other. In the end, people act from what they know, from how they feel. And you don't know. You are not in their mind to be there. You are not in their experiences, in their fear, in their anger. So what they do, we don't have to be like, what they do, as long as we know it is not a good thing to do.
That was the road for you. Rather than wishing for others to suffer, you prayed for change.
For change. And I knew that somehow it was almost like that epiphany moment. I was in the bathroom. First, I want to be the hero who will revenge my mother, my father. And all of a sudden, I realized, especially I was praying, wait a minute. People like Mandela, people I admire, people like Gandhi, I admire. These people have suffered. And yet, they believe in the people to change. They have spent their life teaching people that love is the way, truth is the way, justice is the way. And these people, I admire them. And yet, I want to be like, who, like Hitler? Like people were killing us? How does this work? So in a moment, I realized that people change. But maybe if I pray for them hard, maybe if I they hear my words, maybe they might change. They need to know that love is the way. And we need more people to stand up for that, more than standing up, be joining them in their anger, in their bad doing, in the evil doing. So I really couldn't hear people and I realized that people change. People do evil, but people are not evil.
What inspires you now? You mentioned Mandela, Gandhi. What things do you like to read about? History or music to listen to? What types of things inspire your life now?
You know, any book that is instructive, any book that gives me a new perspective. I mean, I love faith. I love my faith. I read a lot of the Bible. I love interviews. I love personal stories. People who have lived life and who just say what they, how they lived it, what inspired them, and how they went through their troubles. Recently, I read that book, Unbroken, and I saw the movie.
Right.
I mean, you know, just to see other people, especially when they came out stronger. When they came out with a principle that helped them, faith, you know, not let go life or not let go a principle of love and let, you know, it is beautiful, yeah, people's experience.
Imakale Ilibagiza will present Treasures of Our Faith, a weekend of healing and hope, on February 27th and 28th at Fowler, Michigan's Most Holy Trinity Church. Thank you very much for telling that story.
Oh, thank you, too. Nice talking to you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.